Judith, C.E. Montague. 1. The average youth of 20 may expect to live for some 36 years, but if he was an infantry subaltern marching up into the Somme battlefront in the summer of 1916, his expectation of life was 13 days and a bit. Some men took this contracted horizon in one way and some in another. One virgin youth would think only a fortnight wouldn't do to chuck it in the straight. Another would think, only a fortnight, and life scarcely tasted. I must gather a rose while I can. Phil Gresson thought that he was, on the whole, for the rose. So he got a night's leave from Daor, where his company lay for 2 days on its way to the mincing machine at Pozières. Then he borrowed the winking medical officer's horse and trotted off into Amiens, pondering what sort of wine to have with his dinner at Gobert's famed restaurant. Burgundy, he concluded, Burgundy was the winiest wine, the central, essential, and typical wine, the sole and greatest common measure of all the kindly wines of the earth, the wine that ought to be allowed to survive if it were ever decreed that, after 13 days and a bit, only one single wine was to be left alive to do the entire work of the whole heart-gladdening lot. He thought it all out very sagely. Gobert's was full. Gresson just bagged the last single table. Soon the rising buzz of talk drew its light screen of sound in front of the endless slow thud of the guns in the east. Soon, too, the good Burgundy did its kind office, and Phil's friendly soul was no longer alone. All the voices at the other tables had melted into one mellow voice. He recognized it as the genial voice of the whole of mankind at its admirable best, not stiff or cold or forbidding, as some voices seemed at some times. It set him all aswim in a delicious reverie about the poignant beauty of this extreme brevity that had come upon life. 13 days and a bit, and then all love, all liking, all delight to lie drowned forever at the bottom of an endless night. Lovely, lovely. The individual life just a mere wisp of an eddy formed and reformed on the face of a stream and then smoothed away. Oh, it was good Burgundy, and Phil, a modest and a sober youth, drank more of it than he had ever drunk of any wine at a sitting. At 10 he strolled out of Gobert's, full of beautiful thoughts, and decided first to have a look at the celebrated cathedral. He was quite an intelligent boy, and had read that the great Ruskin thought it, all round, the most topping cathedral in France. So he walked northward, along the Rue Saint-Denis to its end, and then to the left to reach the west front. The west front looked all right, as far as he could see, but it was a very dark night, no moon, no lamps lit in the streets, all the shops shut, and not many people about. Far over the southern suburbs, one enemy aeroplane was on duty after another, bombing the railway, and bombs addressed to a railway may be delivered anywhere else. One ancient trade, all the same, did not slacken, bombs or no bombs. Wherever a British soldier walked after dark in the streets of Amiens in that year, a kind of firefly lamps would kindle their tiny electric lights in his path, and out of the deepened darkness that each of these made in its rear, there would come a whispered assurance that some rose was there and only asked to be gathered. In the ears of the undebauched Gresson, most of these voices were more like curbs than spurs to the promptings of youth. But just as he turned from the Place Notre-Dame to go back to the Rue du Soleil, the sudden casting of one of the wee jets of electric light on his uniform and his face was followed by an English greeting that pulled him up with a jerk.
"Alone? At this late hour? What would Mother say?"
The mere words were nothing. Their jaunty jocosity was the common slang of a trade. Nor was it anything out of the way that the words were spoken in English. Half the sisterhood did that in France. What made him stop and say, "Hello," was the quality of the voice. It was everything that nobody could expect from the tongue of a streetwalker hawking her person to any chance ruffian a foreign army might throw in her way. It had depths and reserves, like some rare and gifted woman's most furtive looks. It seemed subtly to index and vouch for many old forces and causes, of slow growth and long operation, character, race, a culture carefully sheltered and long in the building. Besides, the brazen facetiousness had come out, as it were, in spite of some revolt in the speaker. And yet, as he gasped his hello, she acted the courtesan with a will. She flashed her lamp on her own face, her hair, her bust, as if to say, "There, see the goods before buying." Gresson gasped again. The woman was a Juno, no, a tragic muse, tall, deep-bosomed, the regular features grave with a deep and ample expressiveness, the face of one of those most beautiful women who have achieved an intense absorption in some other thing than their own beauty. And she doing this, she that to see or to hear made you feel how gloriously far a woman may be from a mere slave or a mere animal. There must be some enormous mistake somewhere, some sort of fantastic illusion. All the ardent, super-rational respect of clean-minded boys for womankind in the mass was tingling in the voice of Gresson when he made shift to answer politely in his bad French. "And you, madame, under enemy fire?"
"Enemy? German?" she asked.
He explained that the dry buzz which was then growing louder was more smoothly continuous than the hum of any British aeroplane. "He's coming this way," he said. "Look." He pointed upwards at a white patch that had just broken out under the underside of a cloud almost directly above them. At that place, the fiery stares of two British ground searchlights had just rushed together. They had been searching the sky for the raider, each light working on its own, as two town policemen search a suspected backyard with their lanterns. Now one of them had found, and the other had instantly wheeled round to share in the find and to help keep the quarry in sight. Like a fly walking on a high ceiling, a black speck was scudding across the disk that the searchlights painted in luminous fresco on the black dome of night. But the disk moved with the speck. Wherever the speck went, its halo of brilliance was round it. The girl gazed up eagerly. When she sighted the thing that was ranging the sky with its glory all about it, she let out an ah that made Gresson feel sure she was not funked at all, and yet that she was decidedly stirred.
"Like God," she muttered.
It made Gresson start. The words had an aptness, no doubt, to that enskied engine of wrath, remote, alone, girdled with light, throbbing with power, like a Jehovah of old when he floated out on black wings over a culpable earth with his bolt in his hand. But gosh, what a woman to see it like that. French, and yet able to stand off and see a Boche bomber busy above her as anything but a foul vampire bat let out of hell for an hour. Our Tommies might think in that detached way about enemies, but a civilian, a woman, a French one at that, she must be a genius. While Gresson digested this latest course of the full meal of surprise that the evening had brought him, Jehovah let fly to some purpose. When a bomb of some size falls anywhere near in the dark, it feels as if the big splash of flame from the burst were all round you. The sound, too, fills your whole world for a moment. Then there comes, just for a second, a quite remarkable silence, and then certain smaller noises consequent on the original smash begin to rise clear of the silence. When Gresson's eyes and ears came to themselves, a large broken branch of a tree was settling down to the ground with a soft leafy crash of crushed boughs. Some man up the street was screaming with pain, and the singular girl was a blob of black, daubed anyhow on the blackish grey of the pavement. The metal of her little flash lamp tinkled on the stone as it fell out of her slackening hand. He grabbed the lamp and looked at her. She was alive. Her eye flinched under the light. She had no obvious wound, but she had the look that Gresson, a youth now well-versed in bloodshed, liked least of all the looks painted on faces and bodies by the queer artistry of scientific slaughter. It was the battered, bullied look of a mouse kicked to death in the dust. As often happened through the caprices of shellfire, she was stripped half-naked. Her hat, with its flowers, was tumbled and spoilt. The little gewgaws of her pitiful occupation were all disordered. What remained of her clothing was knocked about, dirtied and torn. That grotesque and cruel disarraying moved the young expert in carnage more than he could have believed until he felt it. All thought of sex was gone in a moment. Now she was only a sort of poor human rag doll that had been used as a football, that or a child caught and horribly mauled by some brute of a force while trundling her little soiled hoop through the mud. He laid her easy and straightened her disheveled clothes as well as he could, and then waited a minute, wondering whether a flake of the bomb had done her business for good or only grazed and badly shocked her. In either case, what must he do? Get her to a hospital, he supposed. While he leant over her, thinking, she suddenly spoke, faintly but in the most earnest entreaty, as though she had detected his thought.
"Not to a hospital. No."
"All right," he assured her. "Don't worry." She took a moment of rest, and then said in a voice that tried to be firm,
"Will you help me to rise?"
He tried, and she made a game effort. It was hopeless. One knee was clean out of action. When she attempted to use it, her whole weight came upon him at once. "Madame," he urged, "may I carry you to the hospital? It is 200 yards only." She said,
"No, no, I beg of you, for the love of God,"
so piteously that he was silenced.
"You don't know," she said in a passionate whisper, "the way French hospital people would treat her. A woman like me."
That brought him a new pang of compassion. He couldn't do what she dreaded so much. But Lord, how his mess would guffaw could they see him there now, stuck and perplexed, with the head and neck of a Midianitish tragedy queen sustained in his arms. "But, madame, what to do?" he said, in a voice almost as imploring as hers.
"You'll help me, no?"
she entreated, always in English.
"I live, oh, not very far off with you helping me. I have a friend there. I'll be all right if, with your infinite goodness."
But no mere helping would do it. Shyly and carefully, he lifted her up in his arms, said, "You must tell me the way," and so set off, he knew not whither, through the empty and echoing streets. She steered him up the street of Saint-Denis, along the street of the Three Pebbles, the Regent Street or Broadway of Amiens, and down the smaller street of the Three Naked Bodies Without Heads, to an unlighted house at its far end. Not a soul did they meet on this picturesque progress, except a corporal's party of English military police, out upon their everlasting quest of drunks and strays. As a matter of form, the corporal challenged the odd caravan. He was not scandalized seriously, any natural gift for wonder with which a British soldier policeman set out to scour the streets of Amiens in those days was much assisted to wear itself out. Even the sight of a second lieutenant bearing away a pallid Aspasia with blood dripping from the long heels of her shoes did not astonish.
"Pass, British officer, and all's correct,"
was the formula that the corporal used to disclaim further interest in the incident. Gresson could have wished that the words described the case better. Correct. Why, not to speak of its more general lack of correctness, the girl had moved convulsively in his arms at the corporal's challenge. One of her hands had plunged somewhere into her dress and had not altogether come out again, but he could have sworn that between its half-hidden fingers he saw the shine of a silvery little pistol, the miniature kind that can give you an adequate dose and yet have a remarkably small displacement of air in a pocket. "I shouldn't bring that any further out if I were you," Gresson had said at the moment in his bad French, but in the fatherly tone that an old professional handler of arms of precision may permit himself in explaining the etiquette of their use to an inexperienced young woman. And she had taken it so, had left the firearm in its lair, and had brought the hand out and shown him its palm, open and empty, and said,
"See, I am sage,"
like a French child when it vows to be good. But why pistols at all? And why the queer mode of their entry into the dark little house in the street of the Three Naked Bodies? He was for ringing the bell, but she said,
"No, please bring me near. I will knock."
And then she beat a curious little tattoo on the glass panel with a big ring that she wore. It was as if somebody had been standing just on the other side of the door, waiting in the dark for that tattoo, so immediately did a dim light appear within and the door open. Its opener was a staid woman of 30 or so, in the rig of a hospital nurse, who lost her composure at once, gave a cry of horror, and flung herself on the patient with a wild outburst of sorrow and tenderness.
"She's hurt. Can't walk. A bomb, you know," said Gresson in his bad French. "Permit me to carry her to her room."
The nurse, gulping sobs and alternately charging ahead a few steps and looking anxiously back, gave him a lead up the stairs. Concerned as he still was, it was a relief to be out of the streets. Here he would see, at any rate, no British corporal. Sheltered from public derision, he could take notice of things. And what a house it was! Every lamp, every hanging, every fireplace and chair had the grim, cold, dully classical look common in French bourgeois interiors. He had been billeted in such houses, but the home of the stodgiest trader, the steeliest country attorney, had looked less drearily loyal to the conventions than this, and it an arbor for Venus, a Paphian bower. Why, it was enough to freeze a Bacchant. These women, too. A dim lamp overhead will make almost any face appear grave, but neither of theirs needed that. They made him feel he had gained their goodwill, but also that there was something about them which he was utterly out of, far outside it, and never to come any nearer, and yet unaccountably warmly regarded. Could that be common in women for whom the bedevilment of their womanhood had become a career?
and how the damaged one had stuck the torments that his joggly walk must have inflicted, and Joan of Arc begad. He laid her reverentially down on her bed that the other showed him. Then he put on the right cheerful tone, as he thought, for the sick, and said farewell in his decentest French. Eh bien, au revoir, mesdames. With the most friendly earnestness, the wounded woman said,
No, never, never. If you should ever meet me again by an accident, you are to think only this, that you are in danger, and go away very quickly without looking or speaking. Please do not think me ungrateful. I was not unconscious, not for one little moment, tonight. I know all your courage and kindness and strength, and your clean and delicate art when I was abased. I only say never, because this is the one kind thing I can say without a disloyalty.
She spoke with feeling, as if there were really some dreadful danger, as in the old romances, from which he was to be guarded. Well, he supposed that a woman of pleasure, with all that she knew, must want to warn any man to whom she wished well, to warn him off her own world, with its expensive spirit and its wastes of pain. He looked across at the older woman, as if in appeal against a judgment too drastic. Between the two women there seemed to pass glances that questioned and answered, and then the elder one shook her head too, always with that blended expression of reticence and benevolence. He couldn't help jibbing at the last moment against this decree of finality and his severance from an enigma so beautiful. Madame, he said rather pleadingly, may I not have even a name to remember? She turned her dead white face on the pillow and looked at his eager, ingenuous one, the face of the English nice boy at its nicest, with a sort of fierce kindness.
Yes, she said. Judith, remember it carefully.
She closed her eyes, and the other woman let him out of the house. He went straight to ring at the Hôtel du Rhin and get a bed. He felt, in a way, a little discomforted. Had he not gone forth, like others, to see life and have a good time, as they say? Had not the medical officer winked when he borrowed the horse? What would they say in the mess when he went back and avowed that he still had his ridiculous innocence? Wouldn't they laugh? And yet he was elated, too. He hadn't got what they thought so much of, but he had got what somehow was bigger. The skirts of something high and passionate had brushed him as it passed. In some indefinable way, there was more in the world than before. Life was a taller adventure. 2. An average, however accurately drawn, is only an average. It isn't a maximum. Not through any precaution of his, Gresson survived the next fortnight. He did well in a futile attack and under a smashing counterattack. When the rags that were left of the division were taken out of the line, he was the only officer left in his company, so he was now the acting commander of all the 37 NCOs and men that were left on their legs. Through Albert and Amiens, the dog-tired remnant trailed back at his heels to Ailly on the Somme to rest and refit, and one of its many long halts was made under the trees of the Boulevard du Maille at Amiens, a few minutes' walk from the Street of the Three Naked Bodies. Gresson's own legs felt like sackfuls of lead, but he plodded off to get a daylight glimpse of the casket containing the mystery. All its mystery was gone. A fly-blown house-to-let bill was stuck in a window. The shutters were closed. So that was to be the absolute end of his one Arabian Nights entertainment. He stumped back to the men who were lolling and chafing under the dusty leaves, and in 10 minutes more they tramped off for Picquigny and Ailly. Gresson asked nothing more of God and the great and wise among men that his acting command should be made substantive. But the ways of higher commands are not a subaltern's ways, nor are his wishes theirs. Just when the men were getting comfortably settled in and playing football rapturously in the August dust, orders came to Ailly from on high for Gresson to report at once to Colonel Malham of Intelligence at GHQ. He found this red-tabbed colonel refreshingly unregimental. He talked to a fellow as if such things as ranks did not exist. So Gresson, he said, he seemed to know all about Gresson, had taken an engineering course at Charlottenburg before 1914. Yes, a 2-year course. Did Gresson know Germany well? Some bits of it, yes. Dusseldorf, Cologne, Bonn, Frankfurt, most of the Rhineland. Did he speak German well? Even the humble-hearted Gresson couldn't deny it as flatly as he could deny any imputation of speaking good French. And he and his sister had a beloved Hanoverian governess all the days of their childhood. Anyhow, the colonel cut out any modest shilly-shallying by speaking himself from that point onward in German of perfection that Gresson observed with respectful, though silent, astonishment. Gresson, in turn, seemed to make a handsome impression.
"Gad," said the colonel, reverting to English at last. "Some linguist. You won't be a second lute long."
"I am in acting command of a company, sir," Gresson replied with some pride.
"And that's a damn fine thing to be," said Malham cordially. "I've tried it. I've tried only one thing that's finer. Do you guess what it is?"
"I don't, sir," said Gresson. In fact, he doubted whether the world contained such a jewel.
"It's a game," said the colonel, "with much the same risk, only you take it alone, and you take it dead cold. No one within 50 miles who isn't an enemy."
"I see it now, sir," said Gresson.
"Of course, it's a volunteer's job. I don't press you to go into Germany, don't even advise you. All I say is that, with your local knowledge and very exceptional German, and, if you'll excuse me, your very ingenious mug, you might do intelligence work of deuced high value. Feel like it?"
Gresson's heart was jumping with glee. Why, here he was, at the very heart of the Rose, let into the last, inmost mystery and thrill of glorious war.
"Who wouldn't, sir?" he said.
3. In a snug country house in Artois, a party of British officers seemed to be living a nice, peaceful life of their own for a good part of the war. They did not dine out, but men from neighbouring messes would see 2 or 3 of them on the road and would think what an odd lot they were, and how fresh and unweathered the coveted ribbons that most of them wore, and what indoor people some of them looked, and how much time they all seemed to have on their hands for a walk or a ride. Some wag suggested that they had found a sort of male convent, the latest wonder of the war, where all the official rewards of combatant valour were gained by an innocent life of fasting and prayer. Probably none of the neighbours noticed that now and then one of these persons of leisure would disappear for a few days, or a month, or altogether, nor knew that one of her hermits had just been listed in the Gazette as missing, believed to have died in enemy hands. In this shy place, and in other purlieus of intelligence, the ingenious Gresson now went to school. He learned the whole system and structure of espionage and of counter-espionage, its twin sister. He got up the underground railway, the routes by which escaped British prisoners of war or hunted spies were guided and passed on from guide to guide till a ferry across the enemy line had been reached and the final rush must be risked. He heard about the pigeon post and the little fire balloons that sailed off eastwards on west winds with a pigeon or two in the basket hanging below, and the little flame nicely adjusted to let the balloon down where friends would expect it, about the right distance behind the enemy's front. His mind came to see Germany and the occupied parts of Belgium and France as a map speckled thickly with infinitesimal spots of sound British red, eyes and ears of British intelligence, noting each movement of German troops, guns, supplies, railway metal and hospital outfit. Those were the local agents, and now and then they had to be visited, as a merchant in New York or London visits his outlying agents in China or Africa, just to judge their efficiency and devotion, hearten them up, coach them in the latest modes of publicity, transport and salesmanship, and instill the inspiring faith that good work never passes unseen by the Olympian eyes of the firm, and that shining guerdons await the virtuous. Oh, plenty to learn! And presently plenty to do, not obtrusively.
4. He had become in 2 years a neat hand at the trick, and a major with good marks to his name, when an airman still more boyish than himself put him down in the dusk of a winter evening on a great frozen field in the bend of the Rhine between Godorf and Cologne. In the eye of reason, such a descent was not possible. It was almost as if a German plane had set down passengers in Richmond Park. But some bluffs depend for success upon their very absurdity. They are too mad to be guarded against. Major Gresson's pink-faced pilot had plenty of time to bid the impudent farewell, "So long, old son," and then to rise cannily from the petrified mud and rough grass of the field, and to wind up his steep spiral staircase of air to the height he wanted, before every searchlight from Bonn to Cologne was groping for him all over the sky. A German anti-aircraft gun on a fast motor lorry was on the spot in 5 minutes, eagerly guided for the last few hundred yards by a discharged Bavarian soldier who had seen everything.
"A single-seater, sergeant, a small biplane,"
he informed the NCO in charge of the gun.
"I think this fine had engine trouble. My God, if I'd had my old rifle,
But ach, this forever damned leg, I couldn't even get near him in time. The poor man did indeed walk very lame from the knee wound that had ended his soldiering days and sent him tramping the roads of the Rhineland in his old army tunic and boots, with the interval filled by a pair of the reach-me-down trousers of peace. He also wore the Iron Cross, and he made no secret of a pocket full of chits rebounding enviably to his military honour. His face was young, fair, and ingenuous, but he took a good look at the red-worsted regimental number on the sergeant's shoulder strap before he said much about his own regiment. The little flutter was soon over. The sergeant presented the youthful veteran with a cigar and took himself off with his gun and its crew. Then the lame Bavarian hobbled off briskly along the high road running into the north, where a turbid red glow on the underside of a cloud marked the site of Cologne. The twilight was all but night now. A thin, whistling wind stung the Bavarian's face. The black frost was hardening. About every half mile, the Bavarian stopped dead and listened carefully. Not a boot except his own was ringing on the road. After each time that he thus made sure of being alone, he had much less of a limp and went much faster till it was getting near time to listen again. When the few bleared window lights of the village of Roden came into sight, he limped very badly again. That was a Tuesday evening. In the evening dusk of the following Monday, the super-boyish pilot, with nobody in the observer's seat, was to turn off his engine at some immense height in the sky and great distance away, and slope silently down to the very spot where he had made his first landing. There, if still alive, a German ex-soldier was to be blowing his nose with a white hanky and whistling the Watch on the Rhine, with some slight variations, but always fortissimo. This, you perceive, was a thoroughly reasoned arrangement. Having been caught asleep there only 6 days before, the Germans were sure to be on watch at that point, so sure that it was also sure that no British pilot would be such a fool as to take liberties there for a long time to come. So sure of this were the Germans certain to be that it was quite a sound spec for the British air staff to assume that no place could be safer for that boy to land on next week. You see, we all grew into psychologists during the war. We probed into layer below layer of our enemy's thoughts, second thoughts, counterthoughts, forethoughts, and afterthoughts. Sometimes we brought off grand strokes in this way, and sometimes we didn't. 5. Gresson's long tour of calls on the agents was finished before noon on Sunday. He was enormously glad of it. Each call had been a separate danger. For many spies are in the pay of both sides. It means double money and also protection behind either front and lots of news to be got on each side and sold on to the other. Their double game is often known to one or both of their employers, but even then they may be thought to be useful. Bits of false news may be deftly put in a double spy's way for him to snap up and convey to his second paymaster. But even a double spy may have other and more intractable passions to clash with his deep thirst for coin. He may really be backing one side, he may secretly want it to win, and it may not be the right one. A spy has been known to make a quite dramatic final break with one of his two clients in business. The last time that one capital spy, as he had been thought, was dropped behind the German front, he took a shot with his revolver at the English aeroplane that had just dropped him. Others declare to win, as we say on the turf, by denouncing a fellow spy whom they meet in the country of their choice. Gresson knew all of this, and whatever people may say of the thrills and fine savours of peril, it was never with any flawless and whole-hearted enjoyment that he went into the house of some venal scrub who might at any moment throw up the window and yell for a policeman to lead Gresson off to the slaughter. Between each of these calls and the next, he would rest from fear for a little and look into shop windows or at the scenery till he felt he could do with another dose of blue funk. By midday on Sunday, he was as tired of the hard labour of holding down his apprehensions as you might be if you had been shaved 30 times in a week by a person who might or might not feel like cutting your throat, about even betting each way. Now Gresson, although he was getting on very well as a serpent, in a professional way and for the good of his country, was still a bit of a dove in some other ways. He was simple, he did not keep up with the more brisk-minded youth of his day. He was a poor hand at sneering. It never occurred to him that a thing must needs be wholly rubbish if other people had treasured it for a few hundred yards. In fact, he was unconventional, and he did and thought what he liked without shouting about it. This careless disrespect for current fashion was privately carried so far that he went quite often to church, merely because he liked going.
and though he had no genius for prayer, as some people have, he had a private hobby of glowing when he was in church, with intense and humble longings for things, of the more decent sort that he especially valued or admired, and also of working up a fervent sort of gratefulness, to whom he couldn't say, for everything that had lately gone well with him. So it occurred to him now that having half a day free in Cologne, he would go to the afternoon service in the cathedral. He found an empty seat in the inner south aisle, near a pillar and slightly turned to the left, so that it gave him a view of all the huge nave. There was scarcely another man in the place. All the thousands of women who filled it were wearing dead black, and most of them the dresses of widows, half a furlong of widows. Some of the faces were veiled, and some not. Even of the veilless women, many were soundlessly weeping. Many other faces were marred with the salt scald of more secret tears. The winter daylight was failing, the lamplight was meagre. Opposite Gresson in the north windows, the prelates and saints in heraldic blazonments were sinking into mere lustrous darkness. The dim religious light was its most sombre self, the gothic forest gloom, the death of the short bitter day, the shadows in the hearts of all these smitten women, the great cloud blackening over a falling nation. Gresson felt them all press in upon him together and quiet and soften him. As the service went on, he insensibly gave himself up to it more and more wholly. He let it work upon him as it would. Soon he lost all consciousness of his disguise and his danger, indeed of everything but the rite, the chanting, the figure implied and evoked by it all, the figure of youth and its gifts, even the gift of the clean soul's inner serenity, given up freely for love of something undeservedly beloved. Just to hold alive in his mind the idea of that was an ecstasy to be prolonged at the full height and heat of its joy by gazing intently at something, anything, the flame of a tall candle, the gleam of a lectern of brass. So he gazed level, along a row of the ranged faces, at a light burning beyond, till a trivial movement in front of him broke the precarious spell of this highly strung reverie. One of the faces had made a half-turn towards his own, as though the intensity of his gaze had emitted a jet of some sort that could brush past a cheek and be felt. A woman was gazing at him steadily with an air of utter astonishment. He knew her at once. She wore widow's clothes, her features were thinner, some force would seem to have taken them when they were softer than now and moulded them into a fixed, tragic mask. If all the lost hopes in the world had been shovelled into one grave, such a mask might have been put at its head. Yet he knew her at once. No other face, he was sure, could have had just that proud sculpturing of the brows and the chin, or the poised self-control of the lips and eyes that he had carried in all their harlotry kit through the streets of Amiens. But she here? Why, of course, she too must be here as a spy. Not in the regular way, for she would have been on his list. Perhaps she was one of the fearful women of legend, queenly and monstrous Delilahs, the vessels of sadistic vengeance that have delighted to turn an enemy's lusts into gins and knives to trap him and stab him. He fancied that France had given birth to such women before. The medical officer had told him so. The service was ending, women rising wearily from their knees, shaking their skirts a little and streaming away. The Chimera woman waited a little. Gresson waited too, till she gave him a look or gesture, he wasn't sure which, but he knew that he was being bidden to follow her out. As she moved towards the west door, he fell in behind her. Where a weak lamp burned under the porch, she stopped, turned, and said, "So, it is you?" in the German that all must speak there. "I trust you recovered," he said, "without very bad pain." "Pain?" She seemed to reject the idea that such pains could matter. She looked at his motley get-up as a disabled soldier, discharged and wearing out bits of his old uniform. Her eyes softened a little.
"And so," she said, "all the time you were one of us, and on duty like me in that horrible city. Horrible."
"Us?" His word was little more than a gasp, the escape that must come when the breath has been taken away by some smashing news or strange vision. "Mais vivons quand," he said. "There?" He pointed to the wide flagged space east of the Domhof where nobody used to walk then. She nodded and walked on beside him. He used every second of silence to think the case out in his head and to plan an escape for himself. So that was what she had been, the seductress spy of all ages, and he, the British fool officer who was to babble in her arms.
She might have caught him too. Thank God for that bomb. But now she had him. Caught, done for, the moment his German slipped up or he let out a fact that gave him away. They had reached the big, vacant, flagged square when she asked abruptly,
You knew what I was when you saved me. You knew I was dead if Savants got me into a hospital with the papers I had in my clothes.
He didn't answer. He asked his own question. Papers, madam. British papers. Army funds.
Of course. Every shred I had got on that journey in France.
From British officers? Whom you had? Impudent but uncontrollable anger was flaming up in his mind. To think of poor devils, perhaps his own friends, under their sentence of death, trying to get their last gulp of pleasure out of this world, and then tricked by this dignified harlot into betraying the lives of their men. And yet it was part of his nature to pull in his tongue before it could say the most venomous word. But she understood, partly.
No, she said. Yours was the first British uniform I had approached in that way. That was a miracle. God put a German inside it to guard me. A true German, pure-minded, brave. Yes, it was a miracle. I was like Abraham. I had risked what was most precious to me, and at the last moment my sacrifice had been spared me, and you were the last man as well as the first to whom I was to offer my body.
Amazement was quenching his anger. It shouldn't have done so. It wasn't his job to be moved or to admire. It wasn't the way to get home and bring the goods with him. And yet he was moved. There are times when you feel not to yield admiration even to enemies would be treason to all that is finest in life. He murmured,
You offered that sacrifice.
What woman wouldn't, for Germany, if she knew all that I knew?
Her voice was not loud, but it had the brooding fervor that some women's have when they bend and dote in ecstasy over a child.
Only listen,
she said, and he felt a detaining finger placed on his sleeve. The unlighted streets had emptied. Silence was almost complete. Through it, there rose to their ears the urgent whisper of a great river busy at its work, brushing 100 piers and quays with the insistent swish of its voluminous stream.
So Rhine.
As she breathed the word, she seemed to cling to it and caress it, as if just to utter it were a key giving entrance to gardens of felicity.
The Rhine, and the vines, and the forests, and all the old, kind, simple life of brown, hard-working people in villages, and the songs and dear ways of our own.
He muttered, How could you do it? He had a sister who would have done much for England, but some things were almost unthinkable.
See,
she said more quietly, as a friend reasons with a friend.
My husband was killed in the months of our marriage. My two brothers were killed. I had no sister. My father and mother were dead, and we were losing the war, and my husband had said you could win any war if you only knew what your enemy had in his mind. And you did had won a great war in that fearful way, and why shouldn't I? But oh, the horror of it. Yes, you're right, you understand. The sort of some foul, lusting boar half-drunk with his slobbery tusks. And then the miracle came, and you were courteous and noble and delicate in your heart and hands. Do you know what I wished in my mind, secretly, when I thought you were English? I wished with all the strength of my heart, of course it was only a wild, fantastical wish, that some day that one Englishman, only just he, might be in a danger as deadly as mine was, and I sent to help him.
You would have helped him?
Yes.
Even if his was the very same danger as yours?
You mean if he...
Yes, if he were in Germany doing what you did in France. If you met him here now, skulking about in disguise, and you suddenly saw who it was. Some 30 paces away, across the dark square, a sentry in front of a building paced up and down on his post, with a smart little stamp of a foot at each about turn. Would you call out to that sentry? Said Gresson. He didn't know why he was putting it to the touch and taking her at her word. We don't know why we do many things that we do. Something other than reason, something below it, emits an imperious impulse that comes to the top like a bubble of air from the invisible bed of a pool. It must burst into action. She saw in a moment what he was avowing. She stopped dead. She seemed to grow taller. He felt he had lost the great throw. He was done for, had tried to strike on something that might be responsible in her ferocious and generous mind, and had struck on the ferocity only. In the dark, he could see her eyes burn at him like those of a beast crouching back in a cave.
You dead,
she said with an intense, quiet fury.
You dared to prostitute that uniform, that cross.
The game was all but up, and one thing he could swear would not help him with her, and that was to whine.
You dared verse, you brave woman, he said. You were shameless.
For a second or two she said nothing under his taunt. She stood perfectly still. The queer, clear calm which extreme danger brings to some men had come on him now. He wondered almost tranquilly, was anything within her mind struggling with anything else? Had he a single friend left in that redoubtable citadel? When she did speak, it was low and resentfully.
Fight to God, did you tell me?
God knows. I don't, he said, quite sincerely. Perhaps because you had said things about yourself, frightfully intimate things. It feels better to give a bit back in the confidence line and not do all the talking. Sort of vanity, probably. Well, aren't you calling that sentry?
He asked almost sharply, prompted by some inarticulate guide like a wrestler's perception of when to shift his grip or strain harder or give for a moment.
She made some gesture. He couldn't see what it was.
He guessed it to mean she put off for a few minutes more his sentence of death. Her voice, when it did come, was almost a wail.
What possessed you to come? You, a man with clean fighting to do. A woman has nothing to use but cunning and sex. But a man, what need had you to turn spy? What devil possessed you?
He did not weigh the words of his answer. A hare with the breath of a greyhound hot on her thighs does not weigh this and that. Some god gives her the tip when to double and which way to go, and she does it.
Listen again, he said in his turn, and so pressingly that she too held her breath, and the rhyme could again be heard whispering earnestly. Listen to it, you, he said in a low voice as earnest as its. You think I have got nothing like that in my ears. I live in a house on the Thames, near a weir. When I was a boy, I went off to sleep every night to the sound of the lasher, water tumbling about at the end of our garden, always the same and always changing, like somebody's voice. Well, that's my Rhine. That's the voice of my country, to me. It's what told me to put on this kit and come here. When I lie down in your prison tonight, I shall hear it until I'm asleep. I don't suppose all this is rational. Your Germany may be a much finer country than ours. It's love, so. Isn't that the thing to go by? Doesn't it make everything right that's done for it? Even what you were going to do for it? Even what I'm doing here?
Go quickly, she said, before I remember my duty.
He made out that she was extending a hand in farewell. He found it ungloved and kissed the back of it twice.
You are even more splendid, he said before letting it go, than I sought you that night in Amiens.
And you, she said, have the great heart that I saw in you then.
She hurried off towards the riverside quarter beyond the black bulk of the cathedral, and Gresson hurried off, almost forgetting to limp the opposite way, to hide in the thronged Hohe Strasse and make for the old Severing Gate in the south. Cologne was a sizable city, but not big enough to hold that magnificent woman and him. 6. As punctual as a constitutional king, the plane glided silently down the long slant from the clouds to the field in the bend of the Rhine.
Not napped, sir, yet, the cheerful boy said airily as Gresson scrambled in. Simple souls, these Germans.
Gresson wasn't so sure, but there was no need to answer. The whirling blast from the propeller had begun to blow the hoarfrost off the turf under the plane. Nothing more could be said without effort or easily heard until the many-coloured lights of their home port came rushing forward and upward to bring the frozen traveller in.